From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes, one of Latin America's leading novelists. Also today, cockroaches, traffic jams, and other big city fun with William Geist. A collection of his New York Times columns about New York has just been published. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Characters, the new album from Stevie Wonder, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Nuts, the new movie starring Barbara Streisand and Richard Dreyfuss. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Carlos Fuentes. He's Mexico's leading novelist. His early novels, including Where the Air is Clear and The Death of Artemio Cruz, are widely regarded as the books that signaled the beginning of the boom in Latin American fiction. His novels blend fantasy and reality to describe Mexican history and culture. In his essays, he has criticized American foreign policy toward Latin America. In 1961, he was denied entry into America under the McCarran-Walter Act, which denies access to anarchists, communists, or anyone deemed prejudicial to the public's interest. Fuentes represented Mexico as the ambassador to France from 1975 to 77. His father was a career diplomat. In fact, from the ages of 4 to 11, Carlos Fuentes lived in Washington, D.C., where his father was stationed. Carlos Fuentes visited our studios earlier today. I told him I thought it was ironic that Mexico's preeminent novelist actually spent his childhood in the United States.
Yes. Joseph Conrad spent a lot more of his time growing up in Poland and became a novelist of the English language. There are so many permutations in where you grow up and the space and time you occupy. But, of course, for me, the paramount thing is that no matter where I have grown up and where I have lived throughout my life, the Spanish language is my language. It's the language I can express myself in. I can write essays, I can write journalism in English or French, I can give classes. Even in Italian, but I cannot write creative fiction except in Spanish.
Because that's a language that you were born speaking, or that you
it's
spoke
more than
first.
That. It happens to, well, it's my mother tongue, but yeah. Again, that would not be enough when you think of Nabokov or Conrad. It so happens to be the language I dream in. All my dreams are in Spanish. It happens to be the language I insult in, which is also very important. I don't feel insults in English or French, they mean nothing.
But the word doesn't have the power.
It doesn't have any power, whereas an insult in Spanish really, really sets me boiling. And it's the language of love for me. Curiously, it's the only language I can make love with, which is why I always marry Mexican women who can understand me, I guess.
Well, you know, I think that people who leave their country, either through exile or through choice, feel their country more acutely than those people who've always stayed in it and take it for granted.
You know, there was a wandering, not a minstrel, but an academician in the Middle Ages called Hugo de Saint-Victor, a French scholar, who said this about the problem we're discussing. He said, a person who is perfectly at ease at home in his native land and has no desire to leave is a sweetly innocent person. A person who feels at home anywhere he goes is a superior degree. Yes, he's better off in the world. He has a better place in the world. But only a person who feels he is an exile everywhere is a totally human being. You feel an exile at home and you feel an exile abroad. I have to say I'm in the second category. I feel at home in many places. I feel at home in my own country. I feel at home in the United States. I feel at home in Europe, in the rest of Latin America. I've just spent a wonderful year in Cambridge, in England, made wonderful friends, felt totally at home there. I have yet to feel an exile everywhere, to reach that superior form of existentialist anguish that this medieval monk was speaking about, you know.
When you were growing up in the United States, when your father was a diplomat based in Washington, did you feel especially Mexican or or
well, I was
American.
Made. I was made to feel very Mexican by the American kids, you know, who were rough and tough on me sometimes when Mexico crept into the news. Mexico, you recall, was the kind of Nicaragua of the 1920s and 30s for the United States, the beast down south, the leftists, the revolutionaries, the Marxists, the communists, and all that. And so I was identified with my country and what, in spite of being a child, what my country was doing. And if I had not been identified, well, the American children made me feel identified.
So when you returned to Mexico when you were around 11, did you feel, well, now I can learn what Mexico is really like? You were too young to really understand it when you left.
No, I only came back to Mexico when I was 15 years old because after living in the United States, I went on to Chile and Argentina because I was following my father as a diplomat, you see, and I was a child, a young man. So I only came back to Mexico to live permanently when I was 16 years old, and then it was a great discovery because I had to contrast what I had imagined Mexico to be with what Mexico actually was. And in the tension between my imagination and reality, my literary possibilities as a novelist were born. Because I started dealing with this tension, with this this rupture between reality and the imagined that I experienced when I returned as a teenager.
Could you give us a sense of what you were imagining that didn't exist in reality?
Yeah. I felt that the country was above criticism because it was so assailed by the Americans, so assailed by the United States. I had to defend it constantly. Well, I arrived and I found that it was not a perfect country and that I had to deal with the imperfections as well as with the ideals of Mexico. And I discovered very quickly that criticism is a form of optimism and that when you are silent about the shortcomings of your society, you're very pessimistic about that society. And it's only when you speak truthfully about it that you show your faith in that society, which is something that jingoists and chauvinists in any country, Mexico, the United States, do not understand well.
You've said that as a young man in Mexico, when you were a teenager, around 18 or so, that you started to immerse yourself in the life of the city, and you started hanging around with stripteasers and magicians and mariachis. And I'd like to know whether that was to get a sense of like the bohemian life or to get a sense of Mexico.
No, it was great fun.
That was all.
It was not part of any plan. It was not part of any plan. It was simply that Mexico City was becoming a metropolis in the 1940s, and it was great fun to hang out with all these people. You know, it was such a mixture. Many emigres came to Mexico during the war from Europe. Then when you started getting the persecution, the Red Scares in this country, a lot of people from Hollywood and American left-wingers arrived in Mexico. And it was a nice stew, you know. There were a lot of tendencies, a lot of interesting people. And I was fortunate enough to be a teenager then and to be able to mix with all of this. And with the popular life of the city, which was fantastic. And the city was very beautiful and it was small. You could walk it. You could have it in your hand. Now it spills over. It's like a cancer.
How did your parents react to your hanging out with whores and magicians?
Very badly. They wanted me to be a nice young lawyer. And I just went through that experience, which was fundamental for me as a writer because it was the subject matter of my first novel. If I hadn't lived that, probably I would not have written the first novel I wrote, you see. But it was not considered good form to be only a writer in Mexico at the time. You have to be a writer and something else, a lawyer or an economist or a doctor, plus a writer, because writers were going to die of hunger. You were not supposed to make a career out of writing. And this is the fear my father and mother had. You're going to die of hunger. Well, I think I demonstrated that a writer in Mexico could live off his royalties, off his books. I think, in a way, I was the first professional Mexican writer in that sense. I said, no, I'm going to be a writer, and I'm going to publish books, and my books are going to sustain me, and that I did.
Were there other Mexican novelists that you read when you were coming of age?
Oh, yes, a lot of them. All the novels of the Revolution, for example. Very interesting books about the Mexican Revolution, direct testimonies. Martin Luis Guzman, Mariano Azuela, Rafael Muñoz. Very, very interesting books were there as I grew up. Yeah.
Now, you said it was hard for Mexican novelists to make a living off of their writing. Mm-hmm. When you started writing, did you feel that you were assured of having a certain readership?
I had no idea what would happen. It was like jumping into the sea. So it was a surprise. But you know, I think a writer can never, unless you're really a writer of potboilers and bestsellers, you don't have an idea who your writers, your readers might be. You write what you have to write, and if you get the readers, okay. If you don't, well, maybe one day you will. It's something that cannot come into the consideration of a serious writer, I think.
Did you have a sense early on when you started writing of what your themes were going to be, what it is that you wanted to write about within fiction?
Yes. I think I had a strong sense in my first book of short stories, which were stories of the fantastic and ghostly reapparitions in a sense that next door to the real, there was the unreal, and next door to the living lived the ghosts and the dead of the past. I dealt a lot with that, with the coexistence of old and new civilizations in Mexico. Those themes have been with me all the time. The problem is that when you have these obsessions, how do you deal with them? How do you transform them into literature? How do they remain fresh and not become mechanical? That is a problem I have had. I realize that. And I'm always fighting it, you see, because I would like to grapple with my obsessions for as long as I live, for as long as I write. And those are two synonymous things. But they might become mechanical. How to keep them fresh? That is another problem a writer has, especially when he starts to have a long career behind him and many books. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned this coexistence of reality and unreality, mm-hmm. and reality and magic. And I think one could say that was a kind of theme through the Latin American novel, as we've mm-hmm. as we've come to call it.
Yeah.
And I always have wondered why that is, why there is so much magic and surrealism in Latin American fiction. I don't know if you have any ideas about that.
Yeah, I have many ideas. And I think one shouldn't generalize totally about this, because there are authors in whom this does not occur. We're dealing really with something beyond what you're saying, which is the great theme of fiction, the great theme of novels since Cervantes and Don Quixote, and he inaugurated it, which is the relation between reality and illusion, or between imagination and daily life. The great problem proposed by Don Quixote, which is present in every single novel you care to mention. I don't know a novel where that is not present. What is reality and what is illusion? Only the Latin American novelist, perhaps because of the quantity of unresolved problems in our society, of the burning search for identity in our societies, of the magnitude of our geography, our distances, because of the grotesqueness sometimes of our political life, we've had to deal with it in a more baroque and a more underlined fashion, if you will, because it's the only way to deal with the magnitude of the problems of the characters in history, of the length of the rivers, the height of the mountains. It's a bit overpowering, you know. So the response is sometimes the response of further extravagance, a greater imagination in fiction than reality offers to you. And that is an understandable thing. Mark Twain faces it in the Mississippi with Huckleberry Finn, no? Where is that line between reality and fiction? Well, for us, it is posed every day at the level of politics itself, of government, of nature. So that probably explains that aspect. But coming right down to brass tacks, I think it is nothing more than an inflection on the old Cervantes theme, the Quixote theme of where is reality and where is illusion.
It's interesting that at a time when people in the United States have become more aware of political problems in Latin America, that they've also become more aware of the art in mm-hmm. Latin America, the fiction mm-hmm. and the music. And I wonder if you think that that's a coincidence.
No, as a matter of fact, I think that there is a precedence of the art and the literature and the music to the politics. I think that the presence of writers precedes the political preoccupation or awareness of the American public in relation to Latin America, absolutely. I think people have read García Márquez, and they have read Paz, and they have read Cortázar before they pose to themselves the present-day political problems. This has helped enormously, I think. Yeah.
My guest is Carlos Fuentes, and he's a novelist from Mexico who's actually lived in places all around the world. And Farrar, Straus, Giroux, the publisher, is in the process of republishing all of his novels that they've published. We're going to talk some more about his life and his literature after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist Carlos Fuentes is my guest. In America, you've been considered a pretty radical, politically radical writer. And early in your career, 1961, you were denied a visa under the McCarran-Walter Act for... what were the reasons that they gave you for not letting you into the country?
None. Absolutely none.
You just couldn't get a visa?
I was invited by NBC to debate Richard Goodwin, who was the Undersecretary of State for Latin American Affairs in the Kennedy administration, and to debate the Alliance for Progress. So I accepted this invitation. I applied for a visa at the American Embassy. They asked me the reason, and I said why I was trying to come to this country, and they said that they would have to investigate this. And when I came back, they said, you're not getting the visa, and asked why, and I said, we have no explanation to give to you. So that was that. Recently, my lawyers under the Freedom of Information Act have dug up some of the original documents. They're all blacked out, you know, all stamped out. But originally, I appear under a name which isn't even mine. I'm called Carlos Fuentes Batalla, of unknown mother and father. Imagine.
Especially considering your father's a diplomat, so I say, would not have been hard to track him down.
Yes, imagine. My father was a Mexican ambassador. He was quite well known, and so was my mother. So I was wondering whether they got the wrong man. No. They eventually got me. And the thing is that once you are put into this exclusionary clause and this blacklist, actually, you cannot get out. So I have to get a waiver each time I come here. I get it regularly. My lawyers work hard and get me these waivers. But now I think that these exclusionary clauses are on the way out, that the Supreme Court, I believe, has handed down a decision and they're going to be swept away, which is for the good of the United States. I think it was a very embarrassing thing for one of the signatories of the Helsinki Agreement, which promotes free communication and travel and exchange of ideas, should have such a law in the books.
Why do you think you were kept out back in 61?
I really don't have any idea, because I don't know what danger for the United States or its institutions would have come out of my debating another young man at the time, a man of my own generation, Dick Goodwin, on American television. It would have been good for Latin America, for the United States, to have a frank debate on the Alliance for Progress and relations between Latin America and the United States. So it's one of these silly bureaucratic fears, bureaucratic paranoia, you know, which acts a lot, and it constitutes an obstacle for greater understanding between the two Americas, actually.
You have other friends who are writers who've had trouble being admitted into America.
Oh, a lot. It's a ridiculous list, because it includes, in Latin America, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Nobel Prize winner. It includes Iris Murdoch, the English novelist Graham Greene, Yves Montand, Michel Foucault. Many, many people are put in that list, so it seems rather whimsical. But as I say, I'm happy. I think I'm correct in saying it's on the way out, and we won't be able to talk about this anymore, or to fustigate the United States anymore because of this law.
Does part of you feel pleased, though, that artists are still considered dangerous?
Yes, but they should be considered dangerous for their ideas, maybe not for their physical presence in any place. I think the ideas should be taken more seriously. But if ideas are taken seriously, you don't persecute them. You know, it's useless to persecute ideas.
Well, it's interesting, too, because your ideas in your books and in your essays can be in America without your body being
yes,
here.
Yes, that's right. So it's, there's a kind of ridiculous aspect to this whole exclusionary affair. Yeah.
About yourself politically, you've described yourself as someone who respects Marx but isn't a Marxist. And you've said that there are some people who don't appreciate you because you won't hide yourself in the Marxist church, which you think some Latin American intellectuals sometimes require. Can you explain that?
Yes, I think you know that basically the politics of Latin America, the mold of our politics, is fashioned by scholasticism, by the medieval philosophy of politics of St. Thomas Aquinas, because after all, this is the school we went to for three centuries in Latin America. It is what we were taught during three centuries of colonial rule by our Spanish teachers, that the important thing is not the means, but the ends, the worthiness of the ends, that unity should prevail over plurality, over pluralism, and that the common good is more important than individual individual needs. So this is St. Thomas, and this is what we were taught. Now, when we became modern nations, we put masks on top of this education. First, we put the mask of the French Revolution and Voltaire and Montesquieu. Then we put the mask of Jefferson and American liberalism. And recently we've been wearing the Marxist mask. But these are masks that hide our basic medieval persuasion and these basic ideas about the common good and unity, which I think have been essential. Now, as our societies develop, as they diversify, as more and more social layers are created by economic and social development, then less and less we will have to wear the mask, and we will be ourselves. More and more, we will become Latin American democracies, but democracies based on our own tradition, not on the tradition of the United States or imposed by the United States. This cannot be because we don't have the same history and the same traditions. We have to draw Latin American democracies out of this Thomistic and Augustinian mold and out of the experience of Spain, and it has to go through these sieves if it is to be authentic, you see.
You were an official representative of your government for a while. You were an ambassador to France from Mexico. Did you feel as free to speak your mind when you were an official representative of the Mexican government?
Of course not. If you accept a diplomatic post, you know that you're going to receive instructions from your government, from your foreign office, and you're going to follow those instructions or then don't accept the post. When I was in disagreement with the Mexican government, well, I promptly resigned from the embassy in 1977, and that was that. But as long as I was there, I was, of course, following instructions from my chancellery. Yeah,
you've always been politically engaged in one way or another. Some writers are, and some writers aren't. Were there any writers who inspired you to have this politically engaged kind of fiction?
Well, I don't know if anybody inspired me. I felt it was simply a natural thing to do in my case in Latin America, and that I was doing it not so much as a writer, but as a concerned citizen, and that I would not confuse my writing with my politics. And I think this is something you can say of most of the Latin American writers. You have writers on the left, you have writers on the right in Latin America. But when they're good writers, you don't feel that they're imposing your politics on you or using their novels as soapboxes. On the contrary, they're extremely respectful. I mean, García Márquez on the left, I have yet to see where he preaches any leftist doctrine in one of his novels. Or Jorge Luis Borges on the right, he was not a propagandist for any conservative creed. So this is what I mean, that basically one must understand these attitudes at the level of citizen concern, of citizen activity. And when all is said and done, what matters are the books, not the politics. If we were to judge Balzac or Ezra Pound or P.G. Woodhouse by their politics and not by their books, we would be very, very wrong.
I want to get back to something you said earlier. Yeah. You said that you've had these obsessions and these themes in your life that you've continued to write about throughout your life, and that the difficulty of doing that is to not become mechanical in your writing about it. Yeah. But I guess, you know, as you become better known, and you're so well known internationally now, is it your fear that comfort is going to breed that kind of
no? You simply become blind to certain things that you have been obsessed with taking over and annulling, as it were, your freedom and your capacity for development. And you feel it. Thank God I still feel it when something I'm doing is mechanical. I've said it before and it's coming on and it's a solution I'm going to give because I've always done it. It has been successful in the past. I said, stop there. You're going wrong. Criticize yourself. Debate yourself. After all, literature is a way of debating with oneself. And William Butler Yeats once said a good thing. Out of our debates with others, we make rhetoric. But out of our debates with ourselves, we make poetry. So I would like to be debating myself when these problems arise, you see. And if I'm capable of doing this, I can go on writing. If I give up and let all the mechanics of my past books take over and restate themselves endlessly, then I'm done. I'm through.
English-speaking people read translations of your novels because you always write in Spanish, except for essays, as you pointed out before. Is it frustrating for you to hand that over to somebody else and to have your words not be exactly your words once it's translated?
Well, it's inevitable, you know, and certainly in English or French, since I'm conversant with the languages, I can see what is being done.
Exactly,
But when I'm translated into Russian or Lithuanian or Bulgarian, I haven't the slightest clue of how they've translated me. So what can you do but shrug your shoulders and bear it, grin and bear it? No, generally, for example, I have had very good translations, both in English and French.
Do you read them?
Yes, I do. And I think that by and large they're successful translations. I think the two translations of a novel of mine, Terra Nostra, into English and into French are superb translations by Margaret Peden and by Céline Sands. They're really as good as the original. These are very creative translations. They really render the novel in English and French,
I know that you're very interested in movies and that you've always been a passionate moviegoer. Have you ever written screenplays or anything like that?
Yes, García Márquez and I had a kind of two-man union in the 60s to write movies in Mexico so as to finance our own writing, our own novels. And we did make some money that permitted us to write 100 Years of Solitude and The Death of Artemio Cruz. So hooray for the Mexican producers who massacred, butchered our scripts. But who cares? Take the money and run, huh? We weren't that good because we were very preoccupied with style. We would discuss if in a descriptive passage of the script the commas were right or the adjectives were right. Well, nobody was going to see a comma on the screen. And the writer is somewhat secondary, or a cog, if you wish, in filmmaking, as Fitzgerald and Faulkner found out very, very soon. So I don't think it's a very creative activity for a writer, screenwriting. You're not your own master. A writer is a kind of dictator, an authoritarian as regards his own writing, and has to have this control over what he is doing. Once it has to be transmitted into visual images, you become very secondary. The verbal experience is secondary to the visual experience. And that's that, and that's the way it is.
You spent a good deal of this past year teaching in England, and you're about to teach at an American university starting in the winter session. How long can you go without being at home in Mexico? Is there a length of time where you feel you have to get back, even as a writer, to kind of immerse yourself back in the culture?
Yeah, I go back. I avoid the city. The city has become horrendous, you know. It's so contaminated, and not only physically, it's contaminated morally, and the people are contaminated. But I go to Veracruz and Michoacán and other places I love in Mexico very often, two or three times a year. And besides, I've grown up with a perspective on Mexico from the outside, and which sometimes helps me to see Mexico better, I think. So I have no complaints about this. I like to keep up that tension between living abroad and going back home and being at odds with my country many times, and this keeps the juices flowing.
We're just about out of time. We only have a couple of seconds, but I have to ask you, what makes you so uncomfortable about the people in the city that you're talking about?
They've become too malicious. They've become too angry. They've lost too many illusions. They feel trapped. They feel captured and strike back, and feel they're in a very corrupt world and don't know what to do about it, and cannot strike a covenant between their rebelliousness and their need to accept stability in Mexico. This is the problem we have right now. How to go towards greater democracy without sacrificing the stability that Mexico's had in the past 40 years.
Well, Carlos Fuentes, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Thank you, Terry. It's wonderful to be with you.
My guest has been novelist Carlos Fuentes. He's from Mexico, and his novels have been published in translations around the world. Farrar Straus Giroux is bringing out all of his novels that they have published, and I think their latest one, the latest novel of his that they brought out, is Distant Relations, but you could probably find all of them in paperback on Farrar Straus Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, former New York Times columnist William Geist takes the pulse of the city. For years, Geist wrote the paper's About New York column. The best of those columns have been collected in a new anthology called City Slickers. Also, rock and roll critic Ken Tucker reviews Stevie Wonder's new album, Characters. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Nuts. Barbara Streisand plays a prostitute accused of murder, and Richard Dreyfuss plays her lawyer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. Budget negotiators have hit a snag in their efforts to work out a budget reduction compromise, Republican Senator Robert Packwood said today. A group of at least 24 GOP senators opposed the prospective agreement designed to cut $30 billion from the deficit. But the White House remained optimistic that a compromise will be reached. In a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today, President Reagan urged negotiators to work out the final details.
While the final package may not be all that I might want, it will not be all that Congress wants either. But it is vital that the negotiators complete their work now. Any agreement that comes from these sessions probably will not be the final word on reducing the federal budget deficit. But it will be the right signal at the right time and will show our determination to work together to solve this problem.
The president also said he doesn't think the recent stock market crash will lead to a recession. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden is to meet today with White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker to discuss a confirmation hearing date for Supreme Court nominee Anthony Kennedy. Biden said the hearings were likely to begin about January 20th. Continental Airlines Vice President for Flight Operations today said he did not believe ice was the cause of Sunday's crash at Denver's Stapleton Airport. While he did leave open the possibility that it was the cause, he said ice usually doesn't accumulate on the wings in situations like those on Sunday. The National Transportation Safety Board has concluded 4 days of public hearing in Detroit relating to the crash last summer of Northwest Airlines Flight 255. 156 people died in that accident, making it the second worst air tragedy in U.S. history. Don Gagne of Michigan Public Radio has more.
After 4 days of hearings, the question still remains. Did the pilots on Flight 255 properly set wing flaps and slats prior to takeoff, or was it mechanical failure that led to the crash? In a written statement presented to NTSB officials today, a pilot who was in position to witness the takeoff backed up earlier eyewitness testimony from another pilot that Flight 255's flaps were in the proper position. That directly contradicts statements by NTSB officials who have examined crash debris and flight data recorders. NTSB officials now return to Washington to continue the investigation. A final report on the crash of Flight 255 is not expected until spring. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Gagne in Detroit.
Iraqi warplanes today again hit an Iranian nuclear power station that's under construction. The bombings came despite Iranian warnings that continued attacks could cause a Chernobyl-type release of radioactive materials. The European Economic Community is sending some $11 million worth of additional aid to Ethiopia as that country faces yet another major drought that threatens millions of people. The BBC's Stephen Jessel reports from Brussels.
This emergency aid has been agreed because of the almost total failure of the harvest in Tigray and Eritrea. It's estimated that in those two regions alone, 3.5 million people will need help next year, and that in all, 6.5 million of Ethiopia's 42 million people will be affected. The crisis, according to community experts, is as bad as that of 1984 and 1985, in some respects worse. Much of the emergency aid will be spent on airlifting food from the coastal region to Mekelle in Tigray province, a distance of less than 200 miles. The airlift will last for 2 months. The community is also to pay for the stockpiling of medicine, tents, blankets, and supplies of drinking water and other necessities for the refugee camps, which will, in the view of the community's experts, almost certainly have to be established.
Stephen Jessel in Brussels. Stock prices were sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 44 points to 1895.39. Declines led advances 4-1 on volume of 157 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 64 cents. This is National Public Radio News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Stevie Wonder has just recorded a new album, his 25th. It's called Characters. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I can tell that's big fun tonight. On the corner of Main and Dog Meat Bites. Friday midnight, so would not be right. Without the Reds, party in a nasty fight, but I'll be in your corner. I'll be in your corner if they do.
Stevie Wonder's new album, Characters, is a pleasant shock. It's one of this veteran pop musician's strongest, most sustained performances. At a time when so many of his superstar contemporaries, from George Harrison to Robbie Robertson, are crippled by self-consciousness, haunted by their own illustrious histories, Wonder is confronting the here and now with uncommon directness and common sense.
Skeletons in your closet, itching to come outside, messing with your conscience in a way your face can't hide. Oh, things are getting real funky down in the Oka Red. And it's not just cops that are spanking, it's the stinking lies you tell.
That's the first single from Characters, a song called Skeletons that offers some of the more pointed criticisms of the Reagan era, while never forgetting to maintain a rhythm that will keep a listener interested. For a long time now, Stevie Wonder has conducted his career in a rather schizophrenic fashion. As a public figure, he's been an articulate opponent of apartheid in South Africa, and his support was crucial in the successful effort to get Martin Luther King's birthday declared a national holiday. But while he's recorded occasionally moving songs like Frontline, his salute to Vietnam veterans, his music over the past decade has seemed pretty aimless and self-indulgent. Nobody can deny that I Just Called to Say I Love You is a very pretty song, but it's also very wispy and sweet. That's why what Wonder has done on Characters is so interesting and exciting. He hasn't backed off from his dreamy romanticism one bit. Characters is full of pretty love songs. But most of these songs are informed by a clear-headed point of view. A perfect example of this is You Will Know. In it, Wonder offers standard rock star warnings against drugs and false idols with unusual gentleness and humor.
Lonely one of young, so broken hearted, traveling down the rigid road of life, using pharmaceutical extracts. High but comes down feeling low, gets down on the knees and starts to pray, looking up to heaven for the answer. To hear a voice that says,
I've never before suggested the recording format in which you should purchase an album, but in this case it's important. Both the cassette and compact disc versions of Characters contain two songs that aren't included on the black plastic record, and they happen to be two of the best. Both of these songs, Come Let Me Make Your Love Come Down and My Eyes Don't Cry, are crisp, upbeat tunes that do much to give the medium tempos that dominate the rest of the album a dizzy spin. In other words, if you don't hear this pair of bonus songs, Characters becomes a different, slightly less intriguing collection. That's My Eyes Don't Cry, a song whose jittery polyrhythms are the sort that only Stevie Wonder can pull off. He plays every instrument on this album, every synthesizer, bass, and drum. The only time he uses other people is for the backup vocals. This sort of one-man band stunt nearly always leads to chilly, hermetic music, and Wonder has certainly created his share of cold, self-absorbed material in the past. But there's a warmth and vigor throughout Characters that makes this sort of criticism irrelevant. This album reestablishes him as one of the most vital pop artists around.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Big city life, with its rats, muggings, garbage, and pollution, can seem like a horror movie. Journalist William Geist can turn it into a comedy. From 1983 to 87, he wrote the popular About New York column in the New York Times. He left the Times to bring his quirky takes on city life to CBS Sunday Morning. He's collected some of his Times columns in a new book titled City Slickers. In the introduction to the book, Geist explains why he stuck out at the Times.
The trouble with working at the New York Times is that people at parties are always trying to pin you down on Botswana. When I was working there, I always had to explain to them that I was writing about people who lived in trees in Central Park, sold bullwhips on street corners, hit chip shots out of abandoned cars on New York City golf courses, that type of thing. By choice, actually. I suspect New York is as different from mainland America as Botswana. For the longest time after moving here from the Midwest, I thought everybody in New York was just running a fever, some sort of tsetse fly deal. Here in the nation's thyroid, people scurry about at a frenzied pace. Drivers routinely run red lights, people walk and talk too fast, and many of them eat lunch walking. They eat peculiar things, too. Gnishes, kasha varnishkas, fried kreplach, stuff that might not even be food, I don't know. On a single day, which was not April Fool's Day, by the way, in New York, I discovered a trendy hair salon giving lion urine hair treatments, a man selling Bob's Lucky Potatoes on Wall Street, and investors buying them for luck, too. 150 retro runners competing in a backward mile race to bring attention to their new and apparently serious sport, and a man introducing a line of dog hair clothing.
Gosh, what a job you have.
My favorite quote from one of the people who you spoke with in the book is from a cabbie who said, "I have always considered courtesy a sign of weakness." And I think that really sums up a certain kind of New York mentality.
It definitely does. And there again, I think I got more letters, I think, when I was writing the About New York column from people outside New York than I did from New York itself. People out in the in what I call mainland America, which is where I'm from, really appreciate that kind of quote.
How do you get ideas? Do people call you up with suggestions?
Not often enough, unfortunately. I do a lot of, kind of going through newspapers and all sorts of little publications in New York looking for ideas and trying to stumble across people or places that will really say something about New York.
I bet a lot of people misinterpret what it is that you do and bring you some really stupid ideas.
Yes.
What are some examples?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I'm just bombarded by public relations agencies who call up and you say, you know, that might be representing a chief executive officer of some corporation saying, you know, our CEO plays chess or croquet on the weekends. Don't you think that would be an interesting story for you to do? And sometimes you can reverse that and kind of make fun of them in the process. And sometimes I will do stories like that.
The first major daily that you worked at was the Chicago Tribune. What was your ambition when you joined the staff there?
To hold my job. I mean, I really wasn't sure that I could do it. And then later it became to keep my sanity because they kind of put me out in the suburbs covering library board meetings and sewer bond referendums, things like that. And after a while, you're, again, and like living in New York, you're kind of forced to develop a sense of humor about it or go crazy.
Did that feel like living in exile covering the suburbs?
Very much so. We were out in the suburban bureau of the Chicago Tribune, and whenever anything, let's say a 747 would crash out at O'Hare, they would send out the real reporters and tell us it was fine for us to go about. Somebody had to cover the library board meeting, and so they'd send us along to that.
How did you start covering stories about pink flamingos on lawns and the alarming shortage of leisure suits and other polyester fashions?
Well, there again, that was a few years ago back in the suburbs of Chicago and kind of looking for things that that I could write about and bring some humor to and so on to kind of break out of that meeting the public official syndrome.
Now, you were writing about suburban life. And I think you really wanted to make the point that the suburbs don't conform to the stereotypes that many people have of the suburbs.
I think that's true, yeah. And the same is true, I think, of New York, that it's not, that's a lot of the, I guess, as with New York and the suburbs, I mean, there's so much there that, yes, there are stereotypes are there, but there are all sorts of other things, too.
When you got your job at the New York Times to cover odd things happening in the city, was it difficult for you to orient yourself to Manhattan?
Well, yes, because it was kind of a sensory overload after being out in the suburbs for so long, kind of driving around looking for little things, anything that was different. And here in New York, everything was different. And it was kind of, where do you start? I mean, there were more stories on one city block in New York than there were in mile upon mile of suburban Chicago.
Well, you were also seeing Manhattan from the eyes of an outsider, and probably a lot of things that struck you as totally bizarre seemed perfectly normal to native New Yorkers.
Well, that's true, and that I suppose it can be a problem. They called it at the paper a complete lack of knowledge about New York was identified as a fresh eye. And it's made to be a positive thing. And so the real challenge, yes, was to write it, was to not see something that was just part of everyday life and write about it as if it were something new. Although, in some ways, that was good, too, because in New York, some of the things that are right in front of people's noses, they don't really notice or pay attention to or think about.
Such as?
Just about everything, whether it's something sad, people lying on the streets in front of them to make them actually see these people, or whether it's sitting at sidewalk cafes, the ridiculousness of sitting at a sidewalk cafe with buses going by and bus fumes and people hitting potholes and splashing them as they're trying to be cavalier and sit at a sidewalk cafe.
Did you have to change your style to suit the New York Times style book?
I think any editor at the Times would tell you I never quite fit the New York Times style book, and it was kind of a perpetual give and take and trying to meet in the middle someplace. I mean, they did like the fact that I wrote differently than some of the other people at the Times, but at the same time, they didn't like some of that. So I was generally regarded as a person who got by with more than any other reporter at the Times in terms of style differences. But I also think I had more things taken out than anybody else. In other words, I loaded up the stories, wrote them in my own style, and then they kind of came out somewhere in the middle.
You recently left the New York Times to work for CBS Sunday Morning. How would you compare the kinds of stories you're doing for television with the stories that you covered for the newspaper?
Well, I'm actually trying to do the same kinds of things. They don't always come out that way. It's a whole different experience. At the Times, you know, you just put a notebook in your pocket and go out and spend the time and come back and type up the story. And, of course, there were some changes made by editors for style reasons. But now it's working with a producer and editors and sometimes several producers up the line before the thing actually gets on the air. And so sometimes they get on to my own satisfaction, and sometimes they don't. I mean, it's just a difficult learning process. I'd never done any television at all.
CBS Sunday Morning always ends with scenes of nature, with a waterfall or wild geese or a beautiful country landscape. Do you see yourself as doing the urban equivalent?
Well, that's funny. I did a piece, did one piece for the Sunday Morning program that was the same as a column that I'd done, which was on the new trend of walking. That is, there's a walking store in New York where you can go buy walking shoes or walking outfits that cost like $200. And while we were out in Central Park taping people walking for this television show, we saw a rat run under a bench. And I had the camera crew just kind of do the rat running under the bench as sort of an urban equivalent of Charles Kuralt's nature endings, which was something we showed them there, but they chose not to use.
Yeah, I could see why.
A little disgusting on a Sunday morning with a hangover eating bacon and eggs.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Journalist William Geist, his new book, City Slickers, is published by Times Books. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, on Capitol Hill, it's Zeno's paradox with the budget. The budget is coming to a resolution, but in smaller and smaller increments. We'll have a report tonight. Also, CBS Records is bought by Japan's Sony Corporation, the future of music in America. We also have a profile of Jack DeJohnette. He's a jazz drummer. And a report on buildings that get sick.
Is this going to be about thermostats and high temperatures?
No, it's about indoor pollution. What happens when humans live in a building for a period of years? Bad things happen. We'll find out.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Barbara Streisand is starring in a new movie called Nuts, which she also produced. It's based on a play of the same name by Tom Topor that ran on Broadway in 1980. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Timing for Nuts should be perfect, what with the current raging controversy over what ought to be done about the deinstitutionalized mentally ill. In New York, Mayor Ed Koch is actually rounding them up and reinstitutionalizing them, which raises a lot of questions. Who has the godlike right to decide whether someone is insane? And on what basis? Since those are the questions Nuts poses, you might presume that this is a movie with a powerful sense of urgency and moral conflict. What you get instead is a powerful sense of déjà vu. Barbara Streisand plays a high-priced hooker who has murdered one of her Johns. Her well-to-do mom and dad, played by Maureen Stapleton and Carl Malden, think she's crazy, and so does a dopey psychiatrist, played by Eli Wallach. So now she has to undergo a hearing to determine whether she's mentally competent to stand trial. Richard Dreyfuss, her court-appointed lawyer, believes she's perfectly sane, and since her so-called craziness amounts to little more than being a giant pain, it's not hard to decide where we, the audience, stand on the issue. In scene after scene, we watch the judge, played by James Whitmore, raise his furry eyebrows over the sort of behavior that, at worst, might get an unruly schoolgirl sent to the principal's office.
Do you believe that the defendant is dangerous to herself and others?
Yes, I do.
Define dangerous.
That's for cross-examination.
Ask him to define dangerous.
When a patient is paranoid, and I found this patient to be paranoid.
Ask him to define paranoid, then.
You want to keep your mouth.
And has this patient's history, then I consider such a person dangerous.
Define dangerous.
Mr. Levinsky, if these proceedings are too much of a burden for the defendant, I would be happy to entertain a request for an adjournment.
It won't be necessary, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
We allow a good deal of leeway in these circumstances, Mr. Levinsky. We're not nearly as formal here as in other courts, but I would remind you that the rules of contempt apply.
Ever since Jagged Edge proved a surprise smash, courtroom dramas are all the rage in Hollywood. But Nuts is far from state-of-the-art. It stacks the deck so obviously that it reminds you of the most torpid television plays of the 50s. The big third-act surprise is predictable from early in the first, and there isn't a moment when you find yourself wondering who's right and who's wrong. Nuts is devoid of suspense and moral ambiguity, and yet something makes it watchable. It's not Martin Ritt's flabby direction, nor is it Richard Dreyfuss once again pulling out his familiar array of frazzled huffs and puffs. No, it's Streisand herself. Her performance here is almost over-delivered. All stops out, everything going at once. Sexy, funny, ferocious, angry, and even when her tone seems not to fit the character, mesmerizing. Streisand can't convince us that she's an expensive call girl, that she's committed a murder, however justifiable, or that she's just spent weeks in the nut house. But she can convince us that she has a lot at stake here. In fact, I found myself fascinated by the autobiographical aspects of Nuts. Streisand is, after all, known to be a compulsive perfectionist, difficult to work with, picky and rude, and, well, a giant pain. What with her three obsessively designed houses, her ability to carry on hour-long conversations about her favorite dessert, and her capacity for driving everyone in her vicinity around the bend, some might call her crazy. No wonder Streisand found Nuts an attractive property. This movie is her sanity defense.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Stephen Davis, one of the few baby boomers who made it into the Howdy Doody show Peanut Gallery. That's because his father used to direct the show. Davis has written a history of TV's first hit with kids. Also, Bob Brosman will be back to play a couple of songs on his National Steel guitar. And Ken Tucker will review what's new in home video, including Robert Altman's latest film, O.C. and Stigs, which was never released theatrically. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.